WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Bob Elliott has made a career of spoofing radio and television programs with his partner Ray Goulding. Bob and Ray teamed up in 1946 and since then have had comedy shows on radio, TV, and Broadway. Bob's son, Chris Elliott, is carrying on the tradition of mocking the clichés of broadcasting. Chris is a writer on The David Letterman Show, where he's written in a lot of parts for himself. Perhaps you've seen him as the conspiracy guy or the panicky guy. He's also appeared as celebrity guests, doing his impersonations of Marlon Brando, Morton Downey Jr., and Jay Leno. Chris always comes off like an impulsive oddball, whereas his father is always reserved and moderate. Chris plays against his father's low-key image in a new book called Daddy's Boy, a son's shocking account of life with his famous father. It's a satire of all those confessional memoirs by the sons and daughters of celebrities who reveal how their parents secretly abused them. Bob Elliott was allowed to write a rebuttal to each of his son's chapters. Bob and Chris Elliott are my guests today. I asked Chris to elaborate on the concept of his new book.
Well, basically, it's a shocking, explosive account of my life with a famous father, being Bob of the popular comedy team Bob and Ray, told in frank, often hard-hitting terms, but I think with a certain amount of love and caring from an incredibly bitter son. The unfortunate thing about the book is that for legal reasons, my lawyers were a little concerned that perhaps Daddy here could sue my pants off for some of the things I've said about him in the book, so he gets every other chapter to rebut what I say, which I find rather unfortunate.
Explains a lot about why I'm sitting here and letting him ramble on this way, because I haven't really sat down and read the book. I glanced through his chapters when he wrote them last year, and I understood I was to rebut them, but I saw nothing that was libelous or, well, I really didn't study the material he sent. So I'm embarrassed not to have read it at this late point in the game.
Well, in part for your sake, then, I'm going to ask Chris to read an excerpt.
Yeah, Dad, maybe you haven't heard this part. This is from my chapter.
I'm sure I'd like to.
Called Birthday Hell, in which I describe one of the birthday parties that Daddy was always one to take on and orchestrate. He loved to do that. And this was one where I was not allowed to invite any of my own classmates, as you'll hear. I was always a very shy little boy. I was scared of clowns, and I retreated violently from anything that smacked of audience participation. At a party, if a magician pulled me out of a group as his volunteer assistant, my body would immediately stiffen like a plank of wood, and my scalp would foam up with hot sweat. Anything like a sing-along would elicit the same reaction. I remember needing oxygen at Macy's after meeting Santa Claus, and once I told Ronald McDonald that I wished he was dead. So all in all, I was not a party boy, and no one knew this better than Daddy. Still, my sixth birthday was to be bigger and better than any before. Daddy filled our backyard with every conceivable form of audience participation known to man. Are you enjoying this so far, Dad?
Have you begun it?
There were clowns, mimes, jugglers, puppet shows, magicians, dancers, all eager to involve me in their acts. There were fashion shows, wrestling matches, and Graham Kerr, the Galloping Gourmet, gave a cooking demonstration. It was everything that I hated. I was allowed to invite only two of my classmates. The rest of the invitations went out to Daddy's friends. Among those who attended were Dick Cavett, Al Hirschfeld, and Jerry Vale. Not the most exciting group of playmates for a six-year-old kid. Dick Cavett bent my ear for an hour and a half about peanut butter. But for my dad, the party was a big success. As usual, the press was invited, the television networks set up their anchor booths around the yard, and the Happy Elliott Clan public relations machine shifted into high gear. Music filled the backyard. It was Steve Allen hogging the grand piano. Charles Kuralt wrestled Andy Rooney shirtless, and Art Buchwald rode the giant trained pig. At lunch, the big table was set, and I sat at the head of it, and we ate bean and bacon soup and filet mignon, blood rare, as usual. And the photographers snapped their shots of the privileged life of which the world was so envious.
Now, Chris Elliott, what are some of the books that you read to get in the spirit for this malicious tell-all book?
Well, sort of unfortunately.
I'm sure I've interviewed every one of the authors, by the way.
Probably. I guess I went back to see if there were any books like this, and I found that there were quite a few. Christina Crawford's Mommy Dearest was sort of a template for some of the stuff, and, of course, Gary Crosby's work about it. his dad, and B.D. Hyman's book. There's a little of that in this also. I must say, though, my dad's ignoring my chapters. I find that incredibly bumptious on his part.
Well, Bob Elliott, were you ever afraid that people would read this book and not get the joke and think that you were the kind of father as is described in the book? And,
no.
And that you forced Chris to dress like you and put on a bald wig.
Well, I don't know what that means. But
chapter three, Dad.
Oh.
You really haven't read the book.
No. I was never concerned because I thought I made my points perfectly clear. It was a chance to set down some ideas and thoughts I've had over the years and had no place to go with. And this seemed a real good spot.
Chris Elliott, when you were growing up, how aware of you were you of your father's comedy? Did you hear radio shows? The TV show was already over.
Yeah, the TV show was over, and I heard him on the radio. I was aware he was funny, but I assumed everybody else's dad was too, and it never really occurred to me that no one else's dad had a radio show. He'd leave in the morning wearing a suit and a tie and carrying a briefcase. I'd hear his voice on the radio, and then he'd come back in the afternoon, but I never quite made the connection that he was a performer. I guess when I was about 10 and they had a Broadway show, I started to realize that he makes people laugh for a living and that maybe I could try to rip off the public that way also.
Did he do characters around the house?
No. It was a very normal, dull, I guess is the word I'm looking for.
Good word.
Childhood. There weren't, it wasn't like, a wacky, off-the-wall comedic lifestyle that we led. It was very dry-witted.
I think that really was the secret of Bob and Ray not being wacky or off-the-wall, although some of the material came off that way. But we were very kind of introspective and shy in a certain extent. And when we began radio, we were amusing ourselves.
Well, let me reintroduce you both. My guests are Bob Elliott and Chris Elliott. Bob Elliott has worked for years with Ray Goulding and the comedy team of Bob and Ray, and they've had their own radio and TV shows. And Chris Elliott, you probably know from Late Night with David Letterman, where he has several regular occurring characters, including the conspiracy guy and the panicky guy and the under-the-seats guy. And he's also appeared briefly in Nick and Hillary, was it called?
Very briefly.
Well, as briefly as the show lasted. And together they've written a parody of these confessional books about how children were mistreated by their celebrity parents, and the book is called Daddy's Boy. What I'd like to do is speak with you each individually for a few minutes about your own careers. And Bob Elliott, why don't we start with you?
Okay.
You and Ray Goulding each started off as radio announcers before teaming up together. Was this at the same station?
No. We began at different stations in 1940, 41. And I began in Boston and went into the Army in 43 and came out in 46. And that was when Ray first came to the station.
What kind of announcements did you have to do?
Oh, everything. We did news and we did commercials and at that particular station we did fish reports. Their public service at the time, which every station had to have, and theirs was fish reports, was to broadcast the prices at the Boston Fish Pier when the boats came in. You had to do that three times a day.
Did you have an authoritative voice for that?
Oh yeah, and I knew the boats, and you would say, the Stella B with 14,000 pounds of mackerel and so forth. Well, that's when I first met Ray. It was 1946, and very soon after we fell into the ad lib pattern.
Well, how did you start doing that? How did you start? Well,
out of boredom, I was doing a record show in the morning, and he was the newsman, and along with the engineer, we were the only three there. So after he did the news, he'd stay in the studio and banter back and forth with me each day a little bit longer, and then we would invent characters who would come in, voices, we gave them voices, and became a whole cast, finally.
I think one of the sketches that you also became best known for, The Slow Talkers of America.
Yeah, well, all of those things developed later. They were ad-lib to begin with, though, but that was a big hit in our Broadway show in the 70s, and the Komodo Dragon Expert was another.
Would you say something about the speed of The Slow Talkers of America?
If you have time. I am Harlow P. Whitcomb. I am president and recording secretary of the S T O A, the slow talkers of America.
What was behind the slow talkers of America?
Just somebody that we had interviewed or seen or heard interviewed in the course of our activities as plane announcers, you know. And I'm sure you've met them, too.
Oh, yes. I can assure you I have.
Terrible urge to speed them up, get through this.
I was just watching on video some of the kinescopes from your old TV show, which was on between 1951 and 1953. And you think back to how comparatively primitive things were in the networks at the time
that
you were doing that.
That was what in those days was the network. It was New York and Chicago, I guess, and maybe Philadelphia. And then the kinescopes were air freighted to the West Coast. They were a day late being seen out there. But it was fun. There was no pressure, and everybody contributed a lot more than they do or can do now. And I think it was more fun. I don't know. Seems to me like it was.
When did you give up the radio show?
The last commercial radio we did was about 1977, was on WOR. And then we did three or four 13-week series for Republic Radio, which mm-hmm. is still heard on and off all the time. Any place I go, somebody says, I heard you last week, you know. So it's still on.
I want to ask you what you think of the late-night TV humor, since you've performed on Saturday Night Live, mm-hmm. and your son Chris is on David Letterman all the time. I know that a lot of comedians from who are older now really don't like the late night shows, and they think that they go too far in their language and in their subject matter. I was wondering what you think.
Well, I don't know. I don't really
stay up that late.
No, I stay up. I don't talk to comedians that much. Uh-huh. I have nowhere near the touch with them that Chris does, because he sees them more often. But I enjoy the late night comedy. It's changed a lot, but it's today's comedy, and that's fine. That's good.
Let me talk with you a little bit about your career. Now, you didn't go to college. You just knew that wasn't going to be the direction you were headed in.
No, I didn't have a good time in high school, and I just couldn't see myself in school, and so I didn't go to college. I look back on it. I don't really regret it, because good things happened. Not a lot happened in that 4-year interim that I would have been in college, but I think I sort of got a bit of a head start in what I wanted to go into by not going.
Well, you got started as a page, right, at NBC, and giving tours of the
city? Yeah, actually as a tour guide for Rockefeller Center, which is kind of different. My dad was a page, but I used to take tours around Rockefeller Center, take them into Radio City Music Hall, and up to the observation deck. And, in fact, that's where I first met Dave, because I was up there selling tickets to the observation deck, and Dave showed up one day when he had a morning show at NBC before late night, and he showed up with his mother, and I think it was his mother, and the first thing I did was blurt out who my dad was to try to get his attention, and it did, and I talked to him a little bit, and then charged him the kiddie fare, since he was with his mother, and he went up to the observation deck. That didn't get me my job at late night, but he remembered me when I was hired there. So,
how were you hired?
I had worked at PBS in New York, and there was a writer's strike, and a lot of people that were working in entertainment at the networks were picking up other jobs, and I met somebody who was friends with the producer of the morning show, and so I, you know, had a sort of an in for an interview. I was hired as a runner.
Now, what were the first jobs you did on the David Letterman show?
Yeah, I was a runner, was what I was hired at about $200 a week. And basically, that was just to fetch people coffee and break the Xerox machine and stuff like that. And then I was a PA, production assistant, and in charge of Stupid Petrix, auditioning the people that come on with their parrots and their dogs and cats. I was
terrible at that job, so they promoted me to a writer about a year into it.
When you were doing the auditions for Stupid Petricks, were there terrible and embarrassing accidents?
No, actually, not as often as you would think. There were terrible and embarrassing acts that I just...
Did you feel sorry for people who thought that this was actually going to be funny on TV and it was just dreadful?
I guess I sort of felt sorry for them, probably more than I do now, because now it's such a given aspect of late night. I think people actually go out and buy puppies and train them for a year to do something on late night so they can get on the show. And in fact, I had one guy who did that. I remember, this is years ago when I was auditioning them, that had admitted to me after I had nixed him from these auditions that he had just bought the dog that afternoon and hadn't quite learned how to play the guitar yet. But
what was the first time you wrote yourself into a sketch?
I wrote myself in only after I was hired as a writer, which was about a year and a half into the show. But other writers had written me into pieces from the start. I was on the first show, actually, when Dave did a tour of the studio, and I ended up at the end. He went into the control room, and there was like an Oktoberfest going on there, so I was in Lederhosen and drinking beer and all that. I guess the first running thing was the conspiracy guy that I sort of developed into my own act.
Would you describe the character?
He's just a paranoid guy who was certain that something was going on that Dave wasn't telling us about on the talk show. Whether it meant, you know, if Dave said that they didn't have time for a specific author or a comedian, the guy would jump up and claim it's a conspiracy, and he'd run out of the studio. And eventually he was usually carried out of the studio. I'm confusing the panicky guy. The conspiracy guy was carried out of the studio by two goons, of late night goons. The panicky guy, who was the outgrowth of the conspiracy guy, was pretty much the same thing, except when he ran out of the studio, he was run over by a floor buffer.
How did you come up with these guys?
The idea basically was that here's Chris Elliott. He's a staff member on Late Night, and he wants desperately to be on TV. So he's going to try any way he can to be on TV. And so if you went on that assumption, it was fairly easy just to come up with really lame little characters to do just to get my face on TV. Eventually, people kind of got behind these characters, though, and sort of expected me to perform, which they tend to do now.
Well, did you ever want to be a stand-up comic?
No, I had no... I really did not have a calling at all to stand-up comedy. I tried it once, I think when I was about 16. I went to a comedy club and auditioned with a friend of mine. We had an act that we wrote not dissimilar to some Bob and Ray sketch, but it bombed miserably. I think we went on at 3 in the morning, and I remember trying to save the act by doing a quick impersonation of Lee Harvey Oswald. And The MC came on and said, that's the way to do it. Leave them barfing. So I never went back to stand-up comedy after that.
Was it hard for you to get up your confidence to be on stage after that?
I've sort of forgotten about it. So it wasn't hard. It was hard to walk by that comedy club, though.
You managed to get an article about yourself in Teen Beat,
mm-hmm.
one of these teen magazines.
Yeah.
And if this is the true story, a couple of people on your staff called up and said that.
Well, my manager.
You were a hunk.
Yeah, my manager called up and said that she wanted to package me as, or they, Late Night was trying to package me as a teen idol, and you know, no one at this teen magazine, I think, was over 13 years old, so they didn't stay up for Late Night, and so they said, sure, bring him in. And so, yeah, they took a photo of me in a goofy wig and with my shirt unbuttoned down to my navel, and after that, they had a nice little centerfold there, and I signed it, Love Chris, and stuff. I got a lot of fan mail, actually, at Late Night from a lot of, it was odd, it was a lot of letters like, I can't stay up late enough to watch your show because I have school the next day, but you look pretty handsome. Can I get an autograph? And so I think I crushed a lot of pre-teenage girls' hearts with that one.
Well, what'd you think of how you looked with this wig and with your shirt unbuttoned?
Oh, pretty good, but as you can see, I have a full head of hair anyway, so I don't really need to wear it.
You do a lot of impressions on Letterman, but they're... What's the word I'm looking for here?
Self-referential.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's always sort of, it's still the same joke, I think, with me. It's still, people know, okay, here's Chris trying another angle, and other people do impersonations, so he's going to try them. Occasionally, I'll hit one that is actually okay or passable. People seem to like the Jay Leno that I did.
Thought that was
pretty accurate. But even that, I just called myself Chris. It's kind of a safety net. The impersonations don't have to be too good, because I can still get laughs out of the fact that I'm bad.
Chris Elliott is my guest. And by the way, he's written a new book called Daddy's Boy, A Son's Shocking Account of Life with a Famous Father, which I should say is a funny book.
People are having that reaction.
Right? I don't want people to think this is a genuine expose here. You did a very funny Cable? I think it was Cable, an FDR one-man show parody.
Uh-huh.
That was basically a parody of all the one-man shows on Teddy Roosevelt and FDR and all the Hal Holbrook, Mark Twain type shows. Do you really hate these one-man shows?
I do.
These very actorly one-man shows?
I think I am just drawn to them incredibly. Since I was a kid, I was. And I really don't know why. I saw Hal Holbrook do Mark Twain, and he does him wonderfully, but I've always found some bit of it disdainful and perfect area for my sense of humor to parody.
Well, you always know it's going to happen in a way. There's going to be a flashback where suddenly the kid is 10 and he's afraid and he's yelling for his mommy.
Yeah, it's the talking to the imaginary people that I find really kind of embarrassing.
And there's these sudden shifts between laughter and tears.
Right. Well, it's also, you get to the point where, you know, some of these shows are just badly written, and it gets to the point where they talk about themselves after they're supposedly dead. And you know, it's just like, then I died and 100 people showed up at the funeral, and how would they know that?
But you want to act. I mean, not to do one-man shows, but you want to get into acting.
I'm not comfortable with theatrics. I'm theater. I do want to perform, but I think it'll always have that sort of edge to it that maybe is not the most mainstream. Mm. You know, I'm not sure I'm going to be an actor per se. I think I'll probably end up in the books as a humorist.
Well, that means that it will be hard for you to be cast in other people's movies.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, although I can see myself doing that easier than I can see myself writing a movie for somebody else completely. You know, I think I'll eventually continue just writing for myself and doing stuff that I write and occasionally doing stuff that other people write.
What's your arrangement on the Letterman show now?
I'm on a performance contract. I stopped writing full-time about almost a year ago, I guess, so that I could do outside projects, and look what it's gotten me. So I don't know. I'm in there about 3 days out of the week or so, and I write myself in and then get the hell out of there as fast as I can.
Now, what are the times that you both have appeared on camera together?
Well, it was a memorable role I did in his FDR special, and I played the makeup man, and I was also in the other one,
Action Family.
Action Family.
Yeah, you had
I was a hot dog man.
We had a fight sequence that we did together in that.
Right. Well, you buy a frankfurter from your father, and it's has perfect line of mustard on it, and then you yell at him, you wanted ketchup.
Right, I had asked for ketchup, and so it turns into this perfect Quinn Martin fight sequence from Mannix, and we used a bad double instead of my dad for most of the action, and I think there's even one shot where the double actually just looks at the camera, and it accidentally was not edited out.
Now, how does that make you feel that your son writes a scene for you, and what's the scene? Him attacking you.
Well, it's pretty much, I guess, what he's done here in the book.
That's a really cogent point.
Yeah, it seems to follow in everything he does.
How did the process of writing this book together change your relationship at all?
No, I don't think it changed the relationship any, really. We maintained a remote relationship while we were writing it, and we're leaving separately from here.
Yeah, it's the book tour that's changing it. We're really...
This being together is really terrible.
We're kind of just sick of each other, and it's just begun.
Bob Elliott, I just want to ask you something. You know, you have a reputation for being very funny and, you know, having written all these very funny sketches over the years. You also have a reputation for not being very talkative in public.
I'm not.
Why is it? Because you always think that somebody who's a comic writer and performer would have this gift
for talking. Well, I know. I don't know what it is. again, maybe it's just not liking to talk about what I do. If I were an insurance man, I probably would talk about insurance all the time. Most of them do, but to me, really, our whole careers have been doing what we enjoyed, and it made people, got to people, and once we were off the air, we were within ourselves. I think that's sums it up.
Chris, do you think there's any connection between the work you do now and the kind of comedy your father's done over the years?
I think there's a definite connection with the earlier stuff that my dad and Ray did. You mentioned his 1952 television show. I just recently, a couple of years ago, looked at those tapes of that show. I had never seen them up until a couple of years ago, and I realized that back then, when he was about my age, I guess, if the jokes weren't the same as what I'm doing now, the attack on the idea was sort of the same. There was a lot of self-referential stuff, a lot of double reality stuff, breaking the reality of a sketch, etc. And that to me is very similar to what I've done for almost 8 years on Late Night, and have thought for almost 8 years that I sort of came up with on my own. And I realized that I'm just have been ripping off my dad, and I think that show is different than what people generally now think of Bob and Ray as two guys in suits, sitting doing sort of an interview parody type thing that they later became known for.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us a little bit about your lives and about the new book. Thanks.
Thank you
a lot for being
here. Thank you, Terry.